people have often told me, oh, wasn't she the greatest woman pilot of the 20th century? And the answer to that is a resounding no. She wasn't a bad pilot, but what she did have that these other women didn't have is she was a tremendous feminist, and her MO was to show that women can do it. She wanted to show that women should be able to take the same risks as men and not be judged for it. She wanted women to be able to be reckless.
It's Shelf Life. What do Amelia Earhart and Harriet the Spy have in common? For Laurie Gwen Shapiro, both shaped her obsession with bold women who refuse to play by the rules. In her new book, The Aviator and the Showman, Shapiro reveals how America's most famous flyer became both a feminist trailblazer and the world's first influencer. Stay with us for more on Earhart, myth-making, and why Shapiro still swears by the lessons of Harriet the Spy.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is heading to the U.S. tomorrow, where he'll meet with President Trump and, he says, speak about the Iran war. There's been a pause the last 2 days in American strikes on Iran, but Israel has indicated it's willing to join the U.S. fight if military actions escalate. NPR's Emily Fang reports.
Netanyahu convened a cabinet meeting before departing for the U.S., where he'll attend the funeral of the late Senator Lindsey Graham, who was staunchly pro-Israel. And then Netanyahu will meet Trump on Tuesday. Iran's military spokesperson said Tehran believes Israel is trying to push the U.S. to expand attacks on Iran. In an Israeli poll last month, more than 90% of Israelis said they believed the now-abandoned ceasefire between the U.S. and Iran favored Iranian interests. In addition to Iran, Netanyahu is concerned about a nuclear energy agreement the U.S. just signed with Saudi Arabia, something Israel has long opposed because they fear the kingdom may one day try to develop a nuclear weapon. Emily Fang, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Officials say more than 300,000 people have been evacuated across parts of France and Spain as wildfires continue to ravage southern Europe. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports the landscape is parched after 3 deadly heat waves so far this summer.
Evacuation orders were issued in 5 more villages around the southwestern French city of Bordeaux Saturday night. More than 200,000 people have been forced out of their homes as the main blaze continues to rip through the pine forests of the Gironde region, propelled by strong winds. Thousands of firefighters are being assisted by around 3,000 soldiers and other security forces. European Union firefighting aircraft and helicopters have also been deployed. In Spain, wildfires are continuing to burn throughout the Madrid region. The Spanish government has declared a national emergency, and around 100,000 people have been evacuated. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News.
It's now 100 days until the midterm elections. Democrats in Maine yesterday made their choice to try to take the seat away from Republican Senator Susan Collins, who's held it since 1997. The outcome could decide which party controls the Senate. They selected Troy Jackson, a fifth-generation logger from rural northern Maine, who has served as the president of the state Senate. He's expected to campaign on affordability, along with other issues. Steve Missler from member station Maine Public has more.
Democrats are really trying to draw this contrast between the Trump administration's coziness with wealthy interests and the conditions of ordinary Americans. And it's a direct play into the affordability case Democrats want to make during the midterms amid rising gas prices, inflation, you name it. And Jackson can credibly talk about those struggles because he comes from a poor rural family that struggled to get by.
Steve Missler reporting. This is NPR News. German authorities now say they suspect that last night's attack in Berlin was an Islamist terrorist attack. The interior minister said the suspect is a 21-year-old man who had been radicalized by Islamists. Someone drove a van into a crowd near the Pride Parade in Berlin. One person was killed and 29 others were wounded. Some of the injured had stab wounds. According to eyewitnesses, at least one man had fled the vehicle. Authorities say the suspect is still at large and may be armed with machete. The Interior Department says new rules for managing the Colorado River will come this week after years of negotiations. From member station KJZZ, Alex Hager reports the agency brought 7 Western governors together for a last-minute round of talks.
Those governors represent the 7 states that use the shrinking Colorado River. They're under pressure to rein in demand, but can't agree on how to share water in the future. It appears the meeting did not break their deadlock. In a post on social media, Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs says she remains committed to ongoing negotiations, but steadfast in calling on Arizona's upstream counterparts to share the pain of shortages. The plan's expected to slash the water supply for cities in the Phoenix area. The federal government had to come up with its own plan since the states couldn't agree. Interior may take input from Arizona, California, and Nevada, which are likely to bear the brunt of cutbacks. For NPR News, I'm Alex Hager in Phoenix.
Carlos Beltran, Andrew Jones, and Jeff Kent will be inducted into baseball's Hall of Fame this afternoon at a ceremony in Cooperstown, New York. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Cy Sims Foundation. Since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org.
People have often told me, oh, wasn't she the greatest woman pilot of the 20th century? And the answer to that is a resounding no. She wasn't a bad pilot. But what she did have that these other women didn't have is she was a tremendous feminist, and her MO was to show that women can do it. She wanted to show that women should be able to take the same risks as men and not be judged for it. She wanted women to be able to be reckless.
Hello, and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. Hello. Before you can shape a story, you have to pay attention to the world as it really is, even when it's messy. Even when it stings. That's the lesson of Louise Fitzhugh's classic children's story, Harriet the Spy, and it's the driving force behind reporter and biographer Laurie Gwen Shapiro's career. Now Shapiro has published The Aviator and the Showman, the first major biography of Amelia Earhart in 20 years, a book that arrives trailing lavish praise for peeling back the layers of myth around Lady Lindy. Shapiro is no stranger to improbable tales. In her 2018 book, The Stowaway, she brought to life the story of Billy Goronsky, a teenager who swam the Hudson River to sneak onto an Antarctic expedition, a project she landed by doggedly cold-calling until she found his widow. Before that, she was an award-winning filmmaker. And if you've not yet seen the astonishing documentary Keep the River on Your Right, do yourself a favor and fix that omission. No wonder Shapiro traces the arc of her career to her childhood devotion to Harriet the Spy, the story of a girl who saw the world by writing it down. We also take a look at a favorite short story of Shapiro's, Grace Paley's A Conversation with My Father, a metafiction that asks how stories can reflect real life without oversimplifying it. Laurie Gwen Shapiro, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me here. I'm so delighted to be in Narrowsburg, which is one of my favorite towns in the USA.
We drove up yesterday from Port Jervis. I picked you up from the station last night. And I remember casually asking you at what point you were on the tour for your book. And I got a tsunami of dates and events, from small typical bookstore events to an air show in Oshkosh that draws upwards of 500,000 people. Does a tour like that feel like a victory lap? You know, you don't seem remotely exhausted by it, I have to say.
I'm energized by people. I think that that's something that really helps if you're an author. Part of your job is the research, part of the job is writing, but then you actually have to get the book out. And some people do it remotely, but I love to meet people. And also, I also get new stories when I'm on the road. Mm-hmm. So you have gotten me about halfway through a tour with over 30 spots so far, and I keep getting added to different events every day. But I did launch the book a few weeks ago in New York with the New Yorker author Emily Nussbaum. And then I immediately flew the next day to Atchison, Kansas, where Amelia Earhart is from, for a festival that is huge in the Midwest called the Amelia Earhart Festival, which has 50,000 people coming to her hometown. And then, as you said, the next day I flew to Oshkosh, Wisconsin, and you said 500,000. I'm going to correct that. 700,000 flight enthusiasts come from all over the world. It's the largest aviation event in the world in the middle of Wisconsin. And so I've been doing other events, and coming up, I have Boston, Chicago, Miami, San Diego, Baltimore. It's going to be a wild ride, you know, and I'm booked up until March.
It's a shame you don't have a single prop plane to take you to all these places.
The thing that's ironic about this is that I'm famously a native New Yorker who's a non-driver. So I'm actually going to places around the world without a car. I feel like every time I go out there, it's an episode of Amazing Race. And how am I going to get there? And in this case, to get to Narrowsburg, I was like, okay, I could take the bus or I could take the train, but then I'm going to need someone to pick me up. And that was you.
Well, it gave us a chance to download. I am curious, you're doing all these events with the Amelia Earhart Society, with aviators, with book clubs that hold this legend and this story to their hearts. You must be treading on toes sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. To be truthful, my first exposure of my material to the public was in the New Yorker. I was very honored to have an excerpt about a month before, and it got a tremendous reaction. I got a note from David Remnick about how much he loved it, an email my agent made into a coffee cup. I'm so excited to have that. But then on their social media, they push it out a little differently than I would push it out. You know, something like, was Amelia Earhart's entire career a publicity stunt is not something that I would write, but it's going to get people to click. The New York Times had Amelia Earhart and her horrible husband. You know, people don't realize that authors don't write their headlines. People were saying, have we no sacred space? How are you coming after Amelia? But I'm not coming after Amelia. That's what I think you'll find by reading the entire book, is that she is undeniably brave. She's undeniably ambitious. She changes the world, but she's a real human being. And I think she comes off as braver because of that, including things that I found through untapped archives, both written archives, interviews with people that had never been interviewed. And best of all was about 200 hours of tapes that took me years to find. And I was on the trail, and right before my book was due, I got the call that they had finally been digitized, and they're in the Smithsonian. And I hightailed it right there, and I asked for an extension, because I'm not going to just hand in a book, you know, with having like a quick listen of 200 hours of tapes. I needed to listen to it to allow it to ferment. And I asked for a 6-month extension, and they happily, Viking, gave it to me. And they're very grateful that they did. And I'm very grateful to them. But what's amazing was, what do you do? How do you say something new? And the way to do this is to find archives that haven't been looked at. Big advantage that I had over many other writers is that I signed a deal with a mainstream publisher. And what is very nice is I got a pretty nice advance. And that advance, much to my husband's chagrin, I used a lot on going to the places. You know, he's always like, why don't we put that in the bank? I'm like, well, that's what that money is for. And I ended up going to over 30 states to look at everything, you know, like Robert Caro, turn every page. That's my motto too. He's one of my heroes. And I wanted to see with my eyes as much as I could. And then I also went to Newfoundland, where Amelia Earhart had actually flown out of twice in 1928 and 1932, and went into the town. I'm also, as you know, a filmmaker, and I wanted to go to the places that I'm writing about. I didn't want this to be a flat narrative.
Let's talk about one of the wilder aspects of this particular story, the aviator and the showman. You've mentioned George Putnam a couple of times. He was a kind of literary impresario, started his career with a newspaper, ended up at the family publishing house in New York. What do we know about Putnam and his relationship to Earhart? He kind of modeled her fame, essentially, didn't he?
Yeah, well, one thing you need to know about George Palmer Putnam said he was a very nasty man. Let's get that right on the page. And he was famously so. And Amelia Earhart, in quite the contrast, by all accounts, and after 5 years of research, I can say this, was a lovely human being. And what Putnam was in the Jazz Age was not the head of Putnam Books, which a lot of people get wrong. His uncle, George Haven Putnam, was the head of Putnam Books. I mean, his idea of a good war story was about the Civil War. And in the 1920s, there was a lot of anti-Semitism and racism. The Ku Klux Klan was at its, you know, glory. And there were no Jews allowed in publishing. A lot of the Jewish writers and would-be publishers started their own houses, like Viking, like Knopf, like Simon & Schuster. And they started to have bestsellers. And George Putnam sees his family business kind of losing. They're losing to these people who are taking risks. And he starts to align himself as a nephew, not as the head of the company, to try to sign up adventure books. And one of his first big successes is with Richard Byrd, Commander Byrd at the time, and later Admiral Byrd. And then through his wiles, he gets to Charles Lindbergh. So by 1928, when he's going to meet Amelia Earhart, he's really famous. He's the rock star. You know, that you have to understand that when Amelia Earhart meets him, she's willing to be shaped. This is a famous mentor telling her what she should do.
They end up marrying, I think, in 1931.
Yeah, but not before he's a married man at this moment. He's with Putnam. He's not the head of the company. He's one of five nephews in a game of secession. He marries Dorothy Binney Putnam, the Crayola crayon heiress. I always tell this story, but I'm going to say it again, because my first biography I ever read was a Scholastic book about Amelia Earhart. I still have it. And, you know, he's having an affair with Amelia Earhart. He's a love bomber. He wants something. He goes after it. So there is a sordid story that's been always cut out of the tale of Amelia Earhart. How did they meet? How did they get married? I find that just as interesting as the flights, to be honest with you.
Right. So it's a secret affair, and then it becomes public. What does she see in him? If he's so nasty, what does Amelia Earhart see in George Putnam?
Well, he's charming. I mean, I don't know if you've ever met a narcissist, but they're charming if they want something for you. And also, George Putnam is really well-read. He's very funny. He's literate. His friends, and a lot of people say that he didn't really have deep friendships, but George Putnam would become friends with, you know, the greatest explorers of the age, or he would go after people at the top of the New York Times. You have to understand his office was in West 45th Street. The Algonquin was around the corner. The New York Times, all the publishing houses were there. This was like a fraternity. And so when he heard that Charles Lindbergh had taken off from Garden City, New York, nobody knew that he was taking off then. Other people were freaking out. But George Putnam, with great savvy, I might add, raced to the New York Times office because the New York Times were sponsoring this flight. And he had them telex the office in New York Times in France and said, hey, let them know that Putnam will give you a book deal for $50,000, which is about $1 million in 1927. And when Lindbergh landed, he was broke. And here's somebody telling him, hey, you have a book offer. He goes, yeah, I'll take it. The thing that you need to know is that in 1927, 1928, when I'm talking, it is the Jazz Age. People are taking great risks. There's a ticker tape parade every 5 minutes, but also it's the late Jazz Age. There was a great tiring of the flapper era by this time. The New York Times even had an op-ed saying the flapper is dead. And the new heroes, the rock stars, were the aviators. And partly because of Lindbergh and partly because of a silent film called Wings that Putnam helped place the material for, he was the publisher to the aviators. And this is really fascinating to me.
Before that, he kind of makes his name by sending teenage boys into some of the most dangerous corners of the world, from Siberian ice to alligator-infested rivers. Many of those adventures end badly and some in tragedy. Yet Putnam turned them into bestsellers. How do you see that kind of boy explorer craze shaping his appetite for spectacle and then setting the stage for how he would later market Earhart
Absolutely. This was in my proposal before I had done a lot of research. I had read that Putnam in 1924 had made his 11-year-old kid into a superstar. That was sort of an experiment. And he claimed that his son wrote the book himself. You know, it's not well written, but it sounds like an 11-year-old boy. And by the way, everything that Putnam touches, including Amelia Earhart's books, are all ghostwritten. That's a spoiler alert. But guess what? If you look at the bestseller list of the 1920s, 1924, 1925, David Binney Putnam, his son, dominates the list. And after that, he just thought, hey, this is an untapped market. And he starts going after all American boys. And they're all, I mean, this is the age of eugenics. They had to be a certain type of boy. And he sends them on adventures. And some of them are crazy. Like he sends three Boy Scouts to Africa to shoot lions. But people were just eating this up. And they were selling books. And later on, I will add, since we're in this like kid explorer territory, when Amelia Earhart is on the scene, he adds girl explorers. But they're like 10-year-old girls going down the Colorado River. And so what you asked me is, how is this set up, Amelia Earhart? Well, I tried early on to show the tremendous risks that both Putnam take and Amelia Earhart. Very, very careless risk. Again, I don't want people coming after me. It doesn't mean she isn't brave, but from the get-go, they're taking ridiculous risks. For example, let's go to 1928. Can we go to 1928?
We can go to 1928.
So this is when Amelia Earhart becomes famous for the first time. I mentioned her 1932 flight, but people forget that she originally became famous in 1928 when there was basically what I would call the first reality show. There was a chance to get a book for a woman, whoever got that woman across the Atlantic. And a lot of women wanted to be the first to cross. That was the only glorious thing left. I think there were seven women that tried. Most of them died. So this was dangerous, even to be a passenger. Many of the women were middle-aged women that had watched the suffragettes and they wanted their lives to count. Some of them were pilots that wanted to fly by themselves, but only one or two lived. They were rescued at sea. And whoever went across, even as a passenger, was going to be famous. So the first trip across the Atlantic was Amelia Earhart going across in 28, and she was cast. But this was an incredibly dangerous flight. The person who was doing the piloting, named Wilmer Stultz, was a known alcoholic. In fact, he was even drinking when they took off, and Amelia's throwing bottles of liquor out. And this is the kind of risk that she's willing to take, right? You know, if you make it, it's fantastic. How brave, what an incredible person. But if you look at the risks that were being taken, you could say that my book is sort of leading up to a tragedy foretold.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. I'm talking with Laurie Gwen Shapiro about her new book, The Aviator and the Showman. Laurie, one of the things that you really make crystal clear in this book is that Amelia Earhart was never that comfortable being celebrated for that 1928 transatlantic flight you just talked about. It ended up in Wales in the UK, and she would later quip that she was just baggage, like a sack of potatoes, because she wasn't flying the plane. It's fascinating to me that the very beginning of her fame, she's really trying to correct the record already and say, hang on, I'm not the hero here. Do you see that moment as a kind of origin for this battle against the myth that's being created simultaneously by George Putnam?
Yes, and I think what you need to know is that Amelia Earhart could fly in 1928. She had learned how to fly in California when she was trying to save her parents from a divorce. She was born in Atchison, Kansas, but she ends up all over the world because her father is an alcoholic. Alcoholism has a lot to do with this story. And she is actually at Columbia University pre-med in a night extension school. And on a school break, she goes out to Los Angeles and she goes up in a plane with a man named Frank Hawks, who later becomes a speed maven and writes a bunch of books. But she falls in love with flying there. And she has a brief career as sort of a stunt pilot, but there's no way for her to go forward that way. In 1928, she's a social worker that does hobby flying, but she could fly, but she had no moments behind the gears at all. She was promised maybe a little bit. There was a storm. It was a really risky flight. They could have died at any moment. But when she landed, she was already famous. I mean, she's like toast of England. She's brought everywhere. She goes on a boat ride on the SS Roosevelt, and the menu is changed to be like Amelia Earhart themed. She gets to New York, and there's her ticker tape parade. Like, the men are an afterthought. We've lost their names, basically. And she feels really guilty. And I think what she wants to show is that women can do it. And I think this is where people misunderstand Amelia Earhart. And this comes to me after 5 years of research. People have often told me, oh, wasn't she the greatest woman pilot of the 20th century? And the answer to that is a resounding no. She wasn't a bad pilot. But what she did have that these other women didn't have is she was a tremendous feminist. And her MO was to show that women can do it, and also to champion aviation in general, which is gender neutral. But basically, a lot of the other women that are better pilots than her in the 20th century, and I'm going to list a few if anyone wants to look them up, Eleanor Smith, Louise Thaden, Jackie Cochran, and Bessie Coleman, who died before Amelia Earhart. She was a Black aviator who was amazing, but they were going for their own records. Amelia Earhart, I don't think, was so record-driven. The records did help sell books, but she wanted to show that women should be able to take the same risks as men and not be judged for it. We think about the early astronauts that we knew could probably die. We don't say, how could they do it? How could they be so reckless? She wanted women to be able to be reckless.
I love the way that you convey her kind of recklessness. There's never a moment when she's not aware that this is a dangerous thing to do, but she plows on regardless. There's a very haunting moment on her final flight when she reaches Calcutta. The journey's already been grueling. She's exhausted. The plane is having issues. And in a call to George Putnam, she reportedly confesses that her faith in their navigator, her navigator, Fred Noonan, was faltering. He's drinking a lot. And he tries to dissuade her from continuing that final leg. But she won't hear of it. She's, you know, a woman who, even before she married Putnam, wrote to him, please know I'm aware of the hazards. I want to do it because I want to do it. Beyond the simple question of fame, I wonder how you feel about her willingness to fly in the face of all these risks. And also what that says about Putnam's responsibility as the architect of her fame.
Well, I think, you know, I've been very fortunate to get some very good reviews. I've seen some social media people questioning, oh, am I blaming Putnam? I'm actually saying the responsibility for the death of Amelia Earhart lies squarely on both of them. Amelia Earhart knew exactly what she was into at all times. She even knew who she was marrying. She knew she was marrying a Machiavellian con artist. He bullied other women, but that was her bully. But it was also a way for her to get her flights paid for. She was ambitious. That's been written out of the narrative, that she was wily. You know, she was taught by Putnam to never take too much credit as a woman for her achievements. And yes, she was modest in many ways, but she's also scheming and conniving. But so are all people that get fame. It's okay. I think it's okay to put that on the page, you know? But what the thing that's really interesting about the Fred Noonan moment is that this whole last trip was not necessary, basically. This was a trip for their retirement. There was a movie set up with Bernard Baruch for $1 million. There's all sorts of endorsements. I know we want to talk about Quaker Oats later. There was a lot of money to be made. And remember, the other character in my narrative is the Great Depression. You have the Jazz Age and the Great Depression. It is 1937, And it has been dragging on. You know, they have no money. They are house rich, cash poor. And there was the equivalent of millions of dollars waiting at the end of this trip. And she almost made it, by the way. And they were going to retire and maybe she was going to teach and she was going to fly, but just not these long stunt flights anymore. And that's not the same as 1932 when she's going across the Atlantic, where she's trying to show people that women can cross the Atlantic alone. That's a genuine desire for her. This was a money-making venture. But let's go back to 1937. In March of 1937, she tries to go the other way around the world. And she has a navigator named Harry Manning. And at the very last minute, they add a second navigator named Fred Noonan. And basically, she ground loops the plane in Hawaii. It belly flops on the ground. And the plane is destroyed. If they were broke before, they're very broke now. And so there's a desperate attempt to figure out how to go around the world. Fred Noonan wants to start a navigation school. He has lost his job at Pan Am. He's a tremendous navigator. He's using something called celestial navigation, but he's an alcoholic. And he was fired for his alcoholism from Pan Am. So he's a terrific navigator that came cheap. And Putnam found him. And Amelia Earhart did not trust that he wasn't going to start drinking again. He promises he's going to be sober, but eventually he starts drinking, and he starts drinking in India. But the evidence for this is on the tapes that I found, because when they get to New Guinea, which is the last spot that she was before she left for Howland Island, there are people that are on tape, multiple people in New Guinea, Australians that were there, talking about how Fred Noonan got rip-roaring drunk 2 days before the last flight. I don't think he was drunk when he took off, because Amelia Earhart was furious and took him on a little trip to an indigenous village to sightsee, just to make sure he's not drinking. But they were not in a good place together. She had dysentery. But also, you have to really be very careful trusting anything that George Putnam puts out in the world. Because even her famous marriage letter to Putnam, saying that she did not want marriage to be a cage for her, and if they weren't okay in a year, they should separate, and basically asking for an open marriage.
Wow.
And it's an astounding letter. That actually was a real letter, but he edits it. And you start to realize that almost everything that's been put out in the world as coming from Amelia Earhart has been recrafted by George Putnam. So yeah, maybe he is concerned, but that's after she's disappeared. So has he inserted that? It's hard to tell. But what is obvious is that Amelia Earhart has not learned Morse code. She's gotten rid of a lot of equipment. Fred Noonan, he doesn't have Morse code. These are all dangerous things on the flight. And she's with an alcoholic navigator, and that's partly Putnam's fault. She knows the danger of the flight. And my evidence from that is from a tape that's at the Smithsonian that I found, where Louise Thaden, who was her closest friend, is saying she thought it was totally dangerous to do Howland Island last. That's one of the scariest stretches between New Guinea and Hawaii. It's like the size of Central Park in the middle of the Pacific. And you get that done first when you're not tired.
And Howland Island, just to clarify for the listeners, where she was going to land to refuel. It was going to be her final stop, essentially.
Right. And she pretty much made it there. But an island like that can look like clouds from the sky. It's really tiny. It's easy to miss. And they had a very limited amount of fuel. The thing about this is that other aviators that were very seasoned told her not to take this flight. And she's like very obligated to Putnam because they are broke and they want money. And it's just, I'm going to take one more dangerous flight and then I'm going to settle down.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. I'm talking with Laurie Gwen Shapiro, the author of Stowaway, and most recently, The Aviator and the Showman. Laurie, you did mention in passing Quaker Oats. I think one of the most fascinating sort of narrative threads in this book is the way that Amelia Earhart is what we now recognize as a kind of influencer, maybe the world's first influencer. She was a flyer, but she was really a brand. She endorsed everything from aviation technologies to breakfast cereals. Quaker Oats offered her $5,000 to serve as their world reporter, whatever that means. And yet she also used that money to support her family and bail out fellow aviators. How deliberate was she in building that persona? And what does it tell us about the tension between being a feminist trailblazer and also a commercial commodity?
Well, I think a lot of the credit for Amelia Earhart that we know, and this is going to sound funny after everything I've said, goes to George Putnam. Because the Amelia Earhart, who was a brave, ambitious woman when she was a young girl, was never going to influence millions of people. Okay. And Putnam, for all his foibles, was a genius at promotion. You know, he's in one of the most staid publishing firms of the Jazz Age, and he basically does a lot of inventing. He does things like instant books. He brings in the ghostwriters. So, you know, you want to get a book out as soon as possible. How do you do that? Well, let's get some ghostwriters. Let's just hire some guys from Harvard or Yale that need some money and put them in a room. He also was great at spinning the press. So there's even stories about how Amelia and Eleanor Roosevelt met at dinner one day in 1933 and were talking at dinner and said, would you like to fly over Washington, D.C.? Now, this happened. This flight happens, this famous photos. But do you think for a second that this just happened? The whole plane was lined up, ready to go with women reporters. I mean, that's all Putnam. He happens to be in the corner of the room. Other things that I've seen is Amelia Earhart, the fashion designer. A few, like even her sister is laughing on tape because she had no desire to be a fashionable person. She gets a redo in the 1930s. She gains 10 pounds and she gets photographed by Vogue and Vanity Fair. And she's rebranded as one of the most glamorous women in the world. She's on all the lists. Putnam gets her on the list. And she has a fashion brand called Amelia Earhart Fashions. Well, you know, I went through the archives again, and very small on the bottom of like some ads, I see the name of the actual designer for these clothes. And so there's a lot of like, you know, smokes and mirrors. Do you think Kim Kardashian sits around and designs her clothes or Jocelyn Smith designs her own clothes? Right. But who did it first? I'm going to tell you who did it first. George Palmer Putnam did it first.
Wow.
You know, so but this is, you have to give him credit for that. There's a certain mad genius.
Yeah. You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. I've been talking with Laurie Gwen Shapiro about her new book, The Aviator and the Showman. We'll be back to talk about Harriet the Spy after this.
Hey, it's Tom Kandel from Curtain Call. This week on the show, we travel back to the Catskills in the summer of 1969 when the world was watching the moon landing and thousands were heading to our area to see Woodstock. I'll be joined by composer and lyricist Anne-Marie Milazzo and Drama Desk award-winning actor Andrea Burns to talk about the new stage musical, A Walk on the Moon. We'll learn all about its unforgettable characters, its beautiful score, and the powerful family story at its center. That's Curtain Call, Monday night at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
Wherever you go, take Radio Catskill with you. Stream your favorite shows, music, and podcasts anytime, anywhere with our new and improved app. Stay connected with local news and national headlines all in one place. You can even send us your thoughts with the Talk to Us feature, audio or video, right from your phone. No radio? No problem. Just press play. It's Radio Catskill right in your pocket. Download the app today on iPhone or Android.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. I'm talking with the author and journalist, Laurie Gwen Shapiro. She's just published The Aviator and The Showman. Louise Fitzhugh's Harriet the Spy was first published in 1964. It's often cited as the first truly modern children's novel. Its protagonist is 11-year-old Harriet M. Welsh. She roams her Manhattan neighborhood with a notebook in hand, much perhaps like the young Laurie Gwen Shapiro, recording everything she observes, her classmates, her neighbors, even her parents' friends, with unsparing honesty. What begins as a portrait of a precocious child's curiosity spirals into a crisis when her private notes are discovered by her peers, who recoil at her unvarnished, often cruel, insights. For young readers, Harriet was a revelation, independent, flawed, opinionated, and deeply human. She wasn't the tidy heroine of earlier children's books, but someone who both mirrored and challenged the inner life of her audience. Laurie, you've chosen Harriet the Spy as one of your favorite books. What has it given you personally as a reader and a writer?
Well, it was absolutely one of my three favorite children's books. I'm secular Jewish, but my early school was at Quaker School, Friends Seminary, and everybody was playing kickball. There wasn't a gym, and I was in the corner reading. and I really felt like Harriet the Spy. I was born in 1966, so you said it was 1964 the book came out. So by the time I was reading it, which was probably when I was about 9 years old, I would guess, it was already a big hit. It had been around for a few years, not that long. But I really identified with Harriet the Spy. I wasn't disliked. That wasn't who I was. People thought I was funny or bright, but a little shy. And I was always in the corner reading, but I was also watching people. I think a lot of my writing, even today in my nonfiction, is observational writing. I'm very good at dialogue because I used to write novels, but now I'm able to use source dialogue the way that a lot of nonfiction writers can't do. And I also have a real sense of belonging to one place. Whenever I go back into New York City, which overwhelms a lot of people, I suddenly breathe out like with a Zen relaxation. Ah, I live on the FDR Drive and I'm on a high floor, but I hear the cars whizzing by and it's like the nicest sound in the world to me. I'm a native New Yorker. And as I said earlier in this podcast, I haven't even learned to drive and my husband has begged me never to drive.
I love the native New Yorkerness of you and I love the native New Yorkerness of Harriet the Spy. And it made me think that there is a whole subcategory of children's literature set in New York, from A Tree Grows in Brooklyn to Eloise to Catcher in the Rye.
These are all my favorite books, by the way.
And I began to see the New York child as a very particular type of child. How would you define the New York child in these books? They're quite worldly wise, maybe a little also worldly weary.
Well, you know, I have a daughter, too, who's now 23. And she dressed as Harriet the Spy when she was about 9 years old. I live in an apartment building. It's hard to explain to people that don't live in New York City. I'm not in a fancy apartment building. I live in the Lower East Side. But there are 1,000 people in my apartment building. I basically have a town in my building. And you go to the laundry room and you just can't help but eavesdrop on like sex scandals, you know, things like who's stuffing who. I'm using a little Lower East Side Yiddish here. So what's amazing to me is that I look back at my past and my parents' notes about me. My mom was a would-be writer. And she says, Lori's walking around with a notebook. And then I have pictures of my own daughter doing this with a notebook. And then I talked to my friends who are writers, particularly those who are from New York, and they all thought they were Harriet the Spy, you know, including the men, too. It's just something about being an observer. It allows you to be cool without being in the in crowd. I'm able to just feel like I'm doing something. I'm watching people. And I have gotten in trouble with things that I've written. Not just in journalism, but even in fiction. I think in fiction that, oh, you can just disguise everyone. And at my first reading of a novel, my mother, I said, are there any questions? And my mother was still alive. And she raised her hand and she goes, I love what you did with me. You know, and people can get very out of sorts, even in a fictional representation. And in Harriet the Spy, there's the park that she goes to is still there. I've actually just gone, made pilgrimage and gone to the park and written there pretty recently, actually. Oh, I'll just have a Harriet the Spy day and just take my notebook up to Carl Schultz Park on the Upper East Side, which is, she had more of an uptown childhood than me. I mean, I looked at it again this morning when I knew I was going to talk about it, but I always remember the dumbwaiter, which we don't have in my building. And she's able to go up and down in the building. And I just wanted to have a dumbwaiter. She was really connected to her nanny. She was a rich kid. I was a middle class kid. But, you know, her parents were not that interested in her. One of the things that's really interesting is how she takes different people in her world, and they really are symbolic of people that we meet in our lives. One of her friends, his father is using food stamps and is trying to be a writer. And another, you know, there's other people who are neighbors that are unpleasant. And like, you meet a whole cast of characters. It's so realistic. Now, contrast that to the kind of literature that kids were reading when they were growing up, with fairy tales. And I have friends that love fairy tales, but I love New York stories. Mm. And in fact, what Harriet the Spy did is that she would go to places with a notebook. She wasn't just writing her thoughts. She was observing. She was also capturing dialogue. And I do that all the time in my writing. And I, as I said before, I'm an adjunct professor at NYU. I teach, I'm the features professor. And my students are in the master's program from 22 to 60. And my younger students, many of them grew up in the pandemic and don't know how to go out of their house to do reporting. And they think that making a phone call or doing a Zoom interview is reporting. I'm like, what the heck are you talking about? You have to go to the places. Like, well, we don't have any money. I'm like, get on the mega bus, couch surf. You've got to go to the place that you're writing about. It's going to make your story 10 times richer. And that's a lesson I directly learned from Harriet the Spy.
Well, as you say, there was no Zoom and no cell phones in the era of Harriet the Spy. I also love the dumb waiter. Harriet basically creeps into a neighbor's house, hides in the dumb waiter. The neighbor is a woman who's taken to her bed, but she feels that will extend her life. But some people have problems with that aspect of the book. When it came out, people were uncomfortable with the idea of a 11-year-old girl creeping around in other people's houses, spying on people, taking down dialogue. It wasn't entirely well received.
It was well received by my mother. My mother was a feminist who wanted to be a writer. I think that's really, really important. Who's buying the books for children? One of the first books that, as I said, I bought myself was an Amelia Earhart biography. I circled it on my Scholastic flyer. My mother encouraged me to get it. You know, not everyone has the luxury of having a parent who's a reader, but I really lucked out because both of my parents were readers. But my mom had this extra aspect of being one of the first women to sign up for Ms. Magazine. As soon as she could be a Ms., she was a Ms. And they also had book recommendations. And I'm guaranteeing that my mother would have seen Harriet the Spy from like one of the book recommendations.
Laurie, I think this is a very good time to hear a short excerpt from Harriet the Spy, the audiobook. Let's give it a whirl.
Harriet was trying to explain to Sport how to play town. See, first you make up the name of the town, then you write down the names of all the people who live in it. You can't have too many or it gets too hard. I usually have 25. Sport was tossing a football in the air. They were in the courtyard of Harriet's house on East 87th Street in Manhattan. Then, when you know who lives there, you make up what they do. For instance, Mr. Charles Handley runs the filling station on the corner. Harriet spoke thoughtfully as she squatted next to the big tree, bending so low over her notebook that her long, straight hair touched the edges. "Don't you want to play football?" Sport asked. "Now listen, Sport, you never did this, and it's fun. Now over here, next to this curve in the mountain, we'll put the filling station. So if anything happens there, you remember where it is." Sport tucked the football under his arm and walked over to her. "That's nothing but an old tree root. What do you mean a mountain?" "That's a mountain. From now on, that's a mountain. Got it?" Harriet looked up into his face. Sport moved back a pace. "Looks like an old tree root," he muttered. Harriet pushed her hair back and looked at him seriously. "Sport, what are you going to be when you grow up?" "You know what? You know I'm going to be a ball player." "Well, I'm going to be a writer. And when I say that's a mountain, that's a mountain. Satisfied, she turned back to her town. Sport put the football gently on the ground and knelt beside her, looking over her shoulder at the notebook in which she scribbled furiously.
And that was a short excerpt from the audiobook of Harriet the Spy, written by Louise Fitzhugh and read there by Anne Bobby. Laurie, there's a lot about class in Harriet the Spy, as you mentioned. Her friend Sport cooks dinner for his father at 7 p.m. Harriet sees him making notes in the ledger to track the family finances. And she says, "I hate money." To which Sport replies sagely, "Well, you'd jolly well like it if you didn't have any." I love that line. I loved the way in which class is really important, I think, to understanding Harriet's relationship to the world. She comes from wealth, but she understands quite quickly that luck and money isn't distributed evenly in life. What does that give this book for a child, do you think? The fact that there are different people in it. A lot of that, I have to say, taken out of the adaptation in the 90s.
Well, I've read a study that people that read novels have deeper empathy. Hmm. And I think that's a very good example of empathy being taught to children in a way that's digestible. Everyone I know loves Harry the Spy. Who doesn't want to be, you know, running around with a notebook when you're a kid and feeling that you're kind of special? But secretly, there's lessons of empathy in that book that, you know, you don't necessarily discern when you're 10 years old. Looking back on these classic books, you see it.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. We're talking about The Aviator and The Showman, a new book by Laurie Gwen Shapiro, as well as two of her favorite works, including Grace Paley's A Conversation with My Father. It's often read as a metafictional story about storytelling itself, as much as it is about the relationship between daughter and father. The father, sick and bedridden, asks his daughter to write a simple story in the traditional form, a beginning, middle, and tragic end. He wants something clear and realistic, a story that reflects life's inevitable decline and death. But the daughter resists, producing a story that allows for ambiguity, possibility, and resilience. Laurie, tell me about your love for Grace Paley.
Well, Grace Paley, first of all, I think it's important to say, is a New York Jew. I'm a New York Jew. We're both secular. So I don't know, for me, which is more important, to be Jewish, a woman, or a New Yorker. I think New Yorker than woman than Jewish. I think it's in that order.
But also a kind of red diaper baby, right?
Right.
She was a socialist.
Yeah. My mother was a civil rights activist. She had a black boyfriend in the 50s. She was arrested at Peekskill. My father was a left-wing person, but he was risk averse. They all remembered the McCarthy era, you know, and to be careful. But I think one thing about Grace Paley is just the clarity of her writing. It's the emotional punch of her writing. And also, as a woman, she wrote about being a woman, about being a daughter. And one of the reasons I selected this piece for this podcast is it has this storytelling aspect to it. He's pushing her to expand. He keeps from the bed telling her what he wants. And the story keeps expanding, not necessarily in his direction, but in her direction. But there is a collaborative nature of the final tale that emerges. It's a delightful story. But the other thing about the story that really appeals to me is I had older parents. I had parents that were grandparents age. My father was told he could never have kids. He was partially paralyzed at 20 in 1940 when there was a lack of penicillin, and he learned how to walk again. He had a first wife who died from diabetes. He had seen a lot. He married my mother, who was a working woman who thought she wouldn't have kids. And then my brother was born. So the doctor was wrong. So we were his biological kids. But the point of the matter is that he was a feisty man. And my mother, who I thought I would be traveling around the world with as we got older, my father was older than my mother. My mother died at 80, and my father then lived forever. And I mean, he lived till 100. And around 93, he was still incredible. Mel Brooks, incredible. And basically, my husband and I convinced him to move back to New York. And he comes back to New York, and I have a young daughter, I have a cat, and he is suddenly alive again. I think he lived another 7 years because he wasn't lonely.
Wow.
But here was the person that I didn't expect to be living with. And I'm spending not an hour or two here, I'm spending years with him. And he knew that I wanted to be a writer that was taken seriously. And I had gotten myself at this point into sort of a chick lit ghetto. I had done some nonfiction, then I had a daughter, and I was writing sort of almost like sausage. And, you know, I was paying bills. I'd still cash those checks, I might add. But I wanted to push myself. And I said, Dad, I want to write your story. You're right here. And he goes, yeah, I don't want you to tell my story. I'm not interested. And, you know, the more he did that, the more interesting he was to me. And I ended up writing a piece about my father for Narratively, which is a very good online publication with video from the 50s of when he taught himself how to walk, where he's meeting my mother and wow. all this stuff. And the whole pushback from him is what makes this story really rich. We respect each other, but he's kind of appalled that I'm all over the place and, you know, I should be more Zen and I should get into meditation and I should go on a Zen retreat. We loved each other, though. And I also was a caregiver. I think that's something for people to understand. I'm doing these big books now. I'm able to travel all over the world. But when I wanted to reinvent myself as a narrative nonfiction writer, I was a caregiver to an older man. And I had a teenager who was up to teenager stuff. I was sandwiched in between. And I felt nothing was going to happen for me. How do I get out of it? And my father said, you're a storyteller. You love the truth. Why don't you start working on narrative nonfiction? And I said, how about you? And he goes, get out of here. And that was really where I began. And that piece went pretty viral for Narratively. And then I went back to my agent and I said, I don't want to write these novels anymore. I want to write this. And she said to me, that's not who you are. And I realized, well, that you're no longer my agent.
Good response.
And I found an agent who kind of got what I was saying. And she said, well, you're going to have to use some of these clips and just, well, I want to represent you. I could see your ambition. And within 7 weeks, I had found the story of the stowaway, which was the book about the young man that jumped into the Hudson River and went to Antarctica. And I was able to get a book deal with Simon & Schuster based on a proposal. You sell a book, a nonfiction book, on a proposal. I went to Antarctica with my father's blessings. Not everybody has that support system, but it was a break also from caregiving. And I just want anyone that's listening to the podcast to realize that writing in particular is something where you're not used up at 15. This is not gymnastics. You're actually a better writer if you have life experience.
Well, that makes me feel a whole lot better. I think it will make a lot of our listeners feel better, too. It's wonderful to hear a writer who seems to be at the height of her powers.
Oh, I'm just getting going.
Thank you so much. This has been such a pleasure. I really enjoyed having this chat with you about your incredible career. And I can't wait to see what's next.
I love this podcast. This is so in-depth. I was thrilled to be on it.
We've been talking about The Aviator and the Showman by my guest, Laurie Gwen Shapiro, published by Viking. Harriet the Spy by Louise Fitzhugh, published by HarperCollins. And Grace Paley's short story from the collection A Grace Paley Reader, edited by Kevin Bowen and Nora Paley, with an introduction by George Saunders, published by FSG. Shelf Life is a production of One Grand Books and Grand Journal in association with WJFF Radio Catskill. My thanks as always to my producer Ilya Maritz and sound engineer and composer Tim Wood. And if you like the episode, you can find plenty more on any good podcasting platform, with guests such as John Waters, Melissa Gilbert, Ari Shapiro, and Jeanette Winterson. While you're there, why not give us a 5-star rating that will help others find the show?
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Neversink General Store, featuring catering for parties, meetings, and weddings, gourmet deli, pizzeria, and groceries inside a gas station. NeversinkGeneralStore.com, and from listeners like you.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, Bella Freud. She's a clothing designer and host of Fashion Neurosis, a conversation podcast about the connection between clothes and identity. It's an unconventional setup where Freud's guests lie on a couch. Her great-grandfather was the legendary psychoanalyst Sigmund Freud. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures, here on this public radio station.
This afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Looking for things to do? Check out Radio Catskill's community calendar. Find out what's happening or submit your own event. The community calendar at wjffradio.org.